Yeah. Now, D is remarks about dates. It used to be that people thought that history consisted of memorizing a great many dates, which didn't have much meaning for them. There's no special point in that. However, dates are like the skeleton. If you don't have some idea of the principal one, you don't know the relationship of the event. And therefore, a certain number of them are of very great importance. There are certain periods in which we should know rather accurately when something happened. In other times, within a century or two, will be quite sufficient as we go more in detail in certain periods than other periods. For instance, in what was just mentioned, the life of Luther, the period between 1500 and 1570, there were some tremendously many very important events that it's vital to know quite accurately when a great many of them occurred. In the period before 1500, back to 460, there was not a great deal of importance in church history. And so within a century or two is often sufficient there. Within the period that we will spend the great bulk of our time in this course is between the time of Christ and 460 approximately. And it is very important to know what century, and in general I'd say what third of a century anything happened in, or else you don't see the interrelation of them. I remember hearing about the girl who was trying to learn when Columbus discovered America. She said in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So she thought she had it. And then she had a test, and they said, when did Columbus discover America? And she wrote down 1583. And they said, why didn't you learn the poem? Sure I did. Well, let's hear it. In 1583, Columbus sailed the deep blue sea. I think that's a good illustration of the meaninglessness of learning dates simply as numbers. But to learn dates as showing the interrelationship of events and what happened before something else, is that relationship, they are tremendously important. And so I want you to learn the principal date that we will deal with, but I'm not nearly so interested in the exact year as I am in the third of a century in which something occurred. Now that was D under our introductory heading. E is what is history? And that is something that no one can precisely define. But it is good for us, starting a course in church history, to have a little understanding of what we mean by history. History is not just a list of dates and events that occurred in. Any real history is an attempt to show important changes that have taken place, to give an idea of when and how they have occurred and what their relationship to one another is. It used to be a century ago or even 50 years ago that most history dealt principally with political changes, with wars and with rulers and their relation to each other. Very sensibly, in more recent years, the general idea of history has been spread out to include the most of the people. How did they live? How did their lives change? What were the things that made great changes in their lives? So when we look at church history, it is not just a matter of knowing that a certain man lived, that he preached somewhere, and that he died. That's not what history is. But history is who had an influence on the course of events in the Christian church. How did it come about that certain changes took place? And what is the relation of these changes one to another, and of the people who were influential in making them? So in this course, it is very important that you know the principal facts. Those are the skeletons. And that's the main thing I'm able to mark you on, unfortunately. Because it is pretty hard, unless I took a tremendous amount of time, to fairly mark how well you understand their real relationship to each other. The mark has to be, to a very large extent, based upon your knowing the principal events, the principal facts. But the value of the course comes only perhaps a third of it in knowing the principal events. The value of the course comes in learning something of their interrelationship and of their meaning for us. And that is what I will spend a great part of my time in class dealing with. And I hope that you will derive from that aspect of the course a great deal of value that will be tremendously useful throughout your life. And so I just very briefly speak on this, what is history? because it is good that we have something of a general understanding of what we mean by it. But this is, of course, in church history, so as F, we mentioned briefly, what is the church? What is the church? And there, of course, there you're getting into the field of divine or eternal things, and so the only place to find an answer is in the Bible. And, of course, in Matthew 16:18, we read that the Lord said that on this rock he would build his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. All the forces of evil will not be able to hold in subjection to wickedness those who are presented with the gospel of Christ by the members of his church. And therefore, the church is the body of all the redeemed in all ages. It is the body of all who are saved or ever have been saved or ever will be saved. They make up the church. The book of Ephesians particularly refers over and over to the church as an organism. The church as a body having a head and having an interrelationship between its parts and each part helping other parts and so on. This does not necessarily refer to any particular human organic unity or to a particular human organization, but it does express the fact that Christ's church is an organism. It is an organism related to him as the head, an organism in which when one suffers, all members suffer. It is one. It is not, there are not many churches. There is one church. There are particular groups of Christians, but there is one church, the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. And we are interested in seeing how this church has shown itself in the world, how it has been affected, what it has done which is right, and where it has made mistakes. And from that we can learn much of value for us today. So with these words of introduction, we go now into Roman numeral 1, which we call the world into which Christianity came. While the church includes all who are saved in all ages, in this course we are dealing specifically with those who look back to Christ, not including in this particular course those who look forward to Christ and who were saved through his death, through the sacrifice which look forward to him. We are interested in those who specifically used the name of Christian, the name that was first given the disciples at Antioch. And when you read the histories of the first century A.D., you find practically no mention of Christianity in any book aside from the New Testament. There's hardly a book aside from the New Testament written in the first century A.D., or at least written in the first 80 years of the first century A.D., that even mentions Christianity or mentions Christ. And so Christianity began as a movement which the world of that day hardly knew existed. And it was half a century before any large part of the world of that day would be aware that Christianity existed, at least as far as our evidences on the matter that have come down to us are concerned. And how did it come about that something that started off in an obscure corner of the world, with most of the great centers of the world not even knowing it existed, how did it come to spread to where it became the most important fact in the whole of the Roman Empire eventually? How did that come about? Well, that is a matter that we are interested in this course. We're interested in knowing how it came about and how the church developed during that period. And so as we endeavor to examine that, it is important that we first see what was the situation when the church began. What were the factors that it had to meet? And so our Roman numeral 1 is the world into which Christianity came, and anyone who would look at the world into which Christianity came would immediately then see as the most prominent factor the Roman Empire. So we make that capital A, the Roman Empire. Now, the average Christian does not have any very clear understanding of what the Roman Empire was or what it did. Many people have the impression that the Roman Empire was simply a great, wicked, tyrannical force that set about to try to destroy Christianity and struggled for 300 years to do it and failed. Well, now, that is not the fact at all. It is a fact that in the year 306 A.D., the Roman Empire set out to destroy Christianity. And there was a persecution which lasted in some areas for nearly 20 years, in other areas for less time, but which was a very widespread and tremendous effort to destroy Christianity, and in which probably more Christians were killed or tortured than in all the previous period put together since the time of Christ. That was a tremendous effort of the Roman Empire to destroy Christianity, an empire which failed, an effort which failed. But humanly speaking, if such an effort had been made a century earlier, or certainly if it had been made two centuries earlier, humanly speaking, it would have completely succeeded. And I think we can say that quite definitely, humanly speaking, it would have succeeded, because we know that in China, in the 13th century A.D., in China, there were millions of Christians. There were thousands of churches. And they were completely rooted out by the Chinese Empire's determination to put an utter end to it. And it was completely destroyed out of that area, Christianity was. And it could have been destroyed out of the Roman Empire if they had started earlier, that is, humanly speaking. God permitted this terrible thing to happen in China. And God did not permit it to happen in the Roman Empire. I think that is an important thing for us to remember in our whole understanding of Christianity. When Christianity began, it was like a little tiny flame. You take a match and you strike a match, and there's this little tiny flame, and a little breath of wind will blow it up. And if you're trying to light a campfire, it's good to cap your hands around it, put a hat around it or something, protect it from the wind. Protect it until it gets really going. But once you get the fire really going, then a tremendous wind will only make it go further. It won't blow it out. And it takes a real rainstorm or something then to put it out. But Christianity in the beginning was a little tiny flame, and God protected it with miracles. He gave special gifts to the early Christians that he does not give in the present day. He used special miracles and special wonderful things to protect that until that would grow and spread until there were branches of it in many parts of the world. And then after that happened, then to quite an extent, he left it up to the Christians in those areas to succeed or fail. Not in their own strength, they had to look to him for the strength, but to look to him or to become careless and not look to him. And in many areas, Christianity has gone ahead, and in others, it has died out. And we are responsible, definitely, before the Lord for what happens. We have no right to expect the miraculous interpositions which he gave in the early centuries, or the early decades, when it was just a little tiny flame. So we can expect marvelous works of providence. And so it is important to see how this tremendous Roman Empire, what a force it was exactly, and just what it had to do with Christianity becoming established. And actually, in God's economy, it was more of a help to Christianity, actually, even in the persecution. It was more of a help to Christianity than a hindrance, because of the way God providentially worked things out and led. So that we might call under A, the Roman Empire, number one, the importance of the subject. The importance of the Roman Empire. It was important because it was the most important political fact in several centuries, including the time when Christianity began. And it was a fact with which Christianity had many relationships. But its greatest, perhaps, importance for Christianity was that it provided a tradition of law and of justice, a tradition in which it was possible for people to have certain rights, for Paul to appeal to Caesar, for individuals to be protected against mob action and so forth. Until the time when actually the Roman Empire itself tried to destroy Christianity. But now, before we look more at the nature of this, we will look a little at this Roman Empire and see how it came into existence. Number two,
how the Roman Empire came into being. The Roman Empire was a gradual growth over a period of 4 to 5 centuries before the time of Christ. Actually, you might say the Roman Empire began with Augustus a few years before the birth of Christ, about 27, if I remember correctly. Many would think it began a little earlier with his uncle Julius Caesar, who laid the foundation of it, but who was murdered in 44 B.C. But actually, what they were doing was simply bringing to fruition a long development of a long period before, in which a little group of people living in a little town beside the Tiber River in Italy had succeeded not only in protecting themselves against other peoples that attacked them and tried to destroy them, but in joining with these people, bringing them under their control, and then having them under their control, making them a part of themselves. Not a subject people, but a part of the Roman people. So that there developed a large and strong, unified organization with a constitutional system which provided a very great measure of individual liberty. And this was developed in Italy and in Rome and through the Roman development, and it was one of the most important and effective developments in human history. Because before that, most great organizations simply were dictatorships, and often a whimsical dictatorship in which the ruler would do things as he fancied one direction or another. The Roman emperors always, to a very great extent, were subject to law and to constitution. There was a definite system developed in which individuals had very clear and definite rights. And this system, developing that way, made it possible to have a large enough organization with enough strength to conquer a very large part of the ancient world and to give a very great measure of individual freedom within that area. And it provided a basis within which Christianity could spread. Now, in most of Europe and the Near East before that, say a couple of centuries before that, there you had many little towns, everyone independent. And they were constantly fighting with one another. And there were constantly one being conquered and destroyed by another, and then the children would grow up of the city that had been destroyed, and they would become strong and hate the one that destroyed them, and they'd get strong enough to destroy it. And so, in the great wars of the Roman Empire, there were great numbers of people killed, but nothing to compare with the great number that were destroyed in the rather chaotic condition that prevailed before. Yes, Mr. Caesar?
Yeah,
that was a gradual growth, too. The Roman citizenship gradually spread through the empire. You see, it began with just this little town. Then the little town was attacked by a confederation that tried to destroy it. It maintained itself, and then it conquered one or two of the others. Then, having conquered them, instead of keeping them as subjects, they gave some of them the right of citizenship. And then that group conquered others, so gradually they were extending the citizenship. Until by about 200 A.D., everyone within the Roman Empire was a citizen. But in the time of Christ, maybe it'd be a fourth of the people in the whole empire who was it. But the region was being extended, and the citizenship being extended, but behind it, and about 200 A.D. it taught us. Well, this development then, through the years, developed this constitutional system, a system in which there was a very large measure of individual liberty. At the time of Christ, Italy, most of the Italians were Roman citizens, but most of the other regions at that time were conquered provinces. And some of them were rather poorly ruled by the individuals sent out from Rome, who often exploited the areas and made themselves wealthy through it. But gradually, these provinces were incorporated so that they became not merely subject to Rome, but actually an equal part of the Roman Empire. But it was a gradual process, actually an extension of what had already been in process in Italy long before that. And shortly before the time of Christ, there had come a situation in Rome where you had a number of groups which were tending to fight each other for control, and a situation which could easily have resulted in anarchy, and it was the genius of Julius Caesar that he managed to get control over these various groups in Rome and to establish his control over the empire. But then he was assassinated, and there was a period of anarchy, but his great nephew, who took the name of Augustus, succeeded in establishing a permanent situation, which he never could have done except building on what his great uncle had done, a permanent situation in which all the forms of constitutional government that previously existed were maintained. But the emperor had a power to do almost anything he wanted to. But everything wasn't simply dependent on his whim. There was an established system of order and of justice which went on unless he interfered with it. And so from that time on, you didn't have the anarchy you'd had in the 50 years before the time of Christ, but you did have a strong central imperial figure who over a period could exert tremendous influence over the whole empire. So that this situation of law with definite measures of individual liberty, very widespread, and with the power of people to move from one part of the empire to the other, made a foundation on which Christianity could be spread much more quickly and more easily than if you'd had the situation of 200 or 300 years before, with hundreds of little states all independent and all fighting each other. It would have been very much slower and harder to spread the gospel. Or if you had had the situation like in the Assyrian Empire or the Persian Empire, where the king was absolute and where everything depended upon his decision. The reign of law in the world established by Rome was a great force in preparing the world for the spread of Christianity. And God used it in his providence. God brought Christianity into the world just at the time when it could most easily be spread this way. Now in the Roman Empire then, number three, we'll say its nature. The nature of the Roman Empire, there are two very important elements. One is a very strong central power. Tremendous power in the hands of the emperor if he chooses to use it. But, second, a great tradition of law and of a large measure of personal liberty. A tradition with which the emperor did not interfere, he might in particular instances or particular areas. But rarely did an emperor interfere in any widespread way with the established rights of originally of Roman citizens, but then which were spread as some rights to all inhabitants of the empire, and then eventually all inhabitants of the empire were Roman citizens. And so there was this system which the Roman Empire established, which was a tremendous help to the spread of Christianity. That's number three, its nature. Now number four, I want to give you a rapid survey of the history of the Roman Empire during the first few centuries of the Christian Church. It just so happens that as we have divided history into centuries, starting about the time of Christ, it just so happens that the first three centuries fairly closely correspond to very different periods in the history of the Roman Empire. That's a rather interesting fact. The first century after the time of Christ is the century when there were two families that reigned in Rome. Two families. There was the line that we call the Julian line after Julius Caesar. The Julian line reigned up till 68, And then through until 96, there was the Flavian line. Three men whose middle name was Flavian, just as Julius Caesar's middle name was Julius. And these two families reigned with only a brief interregnum between them, and they were, on the whole, able people. And they got the empire established on a rather solid basis, which would last, which wouldn't be easily upset if you got an emperor who was capricious or quite unwise. As, for instance, the last one of the Julian line was Nero, who was emperor from 54 to 68. He was the last of the Julian line, and Nero proved to be a very cruel, malicious tyrant, and eventually was assassinated, but it did not destroy the empire. It shows how well established the empire was, that the situation continued, and after an interregnum of about a year and a half, another strong family took control and held it until 96. So you have these two families ruling in the empire, and on the whole, administering it in a very good way. And you find Paul appealing to Caesar. You find the Roman officials in the different cities in the book of Acts, as a rule, exercising their power to maintain order and not interfering in general with the spread of the gospel. When the people in Ephesus thought that their business was being injured by the Christian teaching, and they came together into a big meeting where they all yelled how terrible Paul was and how terrible Christianity was, you remember that the local official spoke to them and told them they'd better be careful, they'd be taken to account by the Roman officials for the uproar of the day. There was no reasonable reason to account for it. And then we read he dismissed the assembly. He told them to go home, and they figured that's what they'd better do. That shows how well, in general, order was maintained by the Roman Empire. And Paul and his associates, unless you could prove they were actually doing something injurious to the state, they were not interfered with, but rather were protected during the greater part of the first century A.D. So the first century A.D. is the century of these two families. I perhaps ought to say a little about the individuals in these, because they are very important in history, and some of them quite important in church history. But I want first to glance at the next century. From 96 to 193, you see, just about exactly the second century. From 96 to 193, you have a period which some historians have thought was the finest period in the world's history. A period in which the very best of what the Roman Empire ever was able to produce was visible. That was the period which we sometimes call the period of the Antonines. I don't know if that's a good name for it, but it's a name often used for it, the Antonines. It's a rather strange thing how this period came, when the third of the Flavians was not as bad as the last of the Julians, but he was a tyrant, and they got people pretty much disgusted at him. And when he came to an end, the Roman Senate chose an elderly senator as emperor, and he took over the power in 96. And this man, Nerva, was emperor only 2 years, but he began a practice which continued for a century. And as far as I can see, it's the finest way of selecting leaders for a nation that there could be. But they only had it for one century in Rome, and I never heard of their having it anywhere else in history. Certainly far superior to the carnival sort of thing we do every 4 years in electing a president. And depending on who's able to make the biggest impression on the greatest number of people with his personality, who makes the important decisions for the next 4 years. Well, this system was an ideal system, in my opinion, which Nerva introduced. Yeah, that is, for any human body to carry on. Nerva looked about. He knew he was along in years. He wasn't going to live long. He was interested in the welfare of the Roman Empire.
So he looked about for a man for a successor who would be the best possible emperor he could find. And he found a general, a Spaniard named Trajan. And Trajan was a very effective general, a very fine man, a man who was greatly interested in the welfare of the empire and its people. And Nerva adopted Trajan. And he adopted him and then declared that as his adopted son, Trajan should be his successor. And so Trajan became emperor by adoption. And for about 30 years, he was as fine a ruler as the world has ever seen of any nation. And Trajan did the same thing. He looked around and he found a man. Neither of these were actually from Rome. They were from within the Roman Empire. He looked around and he found a man who he thought would make a good successor to himself, and he adopted him. His name was Hadrian. And Hadrian, for about 30 years, ruled the Roman Empire. And Hadrian traveled constantly, visiting all the different sections of the empire and trying to plan what was for the well-being of the people and for the upbuilding of life in all these sections of the Roman Empire. And then as Hadrian approached the end of his life, he picked out a good man whom he adopted, who they called Antoninus Pius. And I guess it's after him that they call the whole group the Antonines. And he was not perhaps as great a man as Trajan or Hadrian, but he was a very good emperor also. And Antoninus Pius, when he approached the end of his life, picked out a man who was called Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius, many people think, is one of the great philosophers, one of the great Stoic philosophers. His Meditations have been, many people have loved to read in modern times. And he's considered as a very high class, very fine type of man. But the strange thing is that though Marcus Aurelius is generally considered such a fine type of man, he persecuted Christianity much more than any Antonine before him. And Marcus Aurelius did the bad thing of breaking the chain. Instead of looking around to find someone who would be worthy of being emperor after him, he had his own son succeed him. And his son proved unworthy. And the hereditary system, which has been the curse of so many nations, thus came in at this point, and Marcus Aurelius' unworthy son succeeded him. And people didn't put up with him for very long. But when they got rid of him, the system of adoption was ended. And so the second century of the Roman Empire, one of the golden centuries of the world's history, came to an end because Marcus Aurelius broke the precedent and changed it into a hereditary system. But by this time, the empire was beginning to have tensions and weaknesses, and the barbarians were beginning to attack it from various sides. And from here on, you have the empire in the hands of the army from 193 until 284. You see almost another century. And here in a period of about, within a period of 80 years, you had more than 20 emperors. The army would make a man emperor, and within 2 or 3 years, somebody would assassinate him, and they'd make another man. And that continued for about 80 years, and it's a wonder the empire continued. But so well established was the system that despite these constant changes of emperors, the empire lasted through this system, though there was great degeneration in many regards. And then in 284, the head of the guards, of the imperial guards, who had been the son of a slave, a man named Diocletian, who had been important in the army for many years, seized the power on the death of an emperor, and he, a man of great brilliance, great ability, set to work to reestablish the empire on a solid basis. And so your next period, which runs now for about 70 years, about 60 to 70 years, there are two men, Diocletian and Constantine. And these were two very able men. There was a period between them. But these two men were men who studied how to improve the welfare of the empire and how to do away with these rapid changes and these assassinations of rulers and so on, and succeeded in bringing an end to that very bad system that had been in effect through the 3rd century AD. Now that's a rapid survey of the history of the political control of the Roman Empire during this period. We'll look at its details more later, of course. It was at the very end of Diocletian's period. And when Constantine came in, he became a Christian. So that is very important in this whole development. But it's right in the middle between these two. And that we'll discuss later rather than take time for it. But this rapid survey I've made this way of these four periods in the history of the empire, periods which cover the greater part of our early period of church history. And we know three or four times as much about church history during the period from 100 AD and 460 AD. We know three or four times as much about it as we do about the period between 460 and 1460, 1,000 years. It was one of the great periods of the history of the world and one of the great periods of the history of Christianity. And we cannot go into all the facts about it, but we can go into a good many of them. And they're very interesting and quite important in our understanding. But before we look at them, we must look at a second factor. No, I'm not quite ready for the second factor. This number 4 was the general survey. I want to mention number 5, advantages for Christianity of the Roman Empire. Number 5, advantages to Christianity of the existence of the Roman Empire. And number 1 here is comparative peace and safety. Number 1 is comparative peace and safety. 200 years before the time of Christ, it would have been a very slow process to bring the gospel from Jerusalem to Rome, because you'd have had little bodies of people fighting against each other or having temporary periods of peace, and it would have been very difficult in getting around. Now you had comparative peace and safety. In fact, in Palestine, up until the time of Christ, or shortly before it, it was always dangerous to get outside of the town because there were so many bandits. But the Roman soldiers, when they took over Palestine, put an end to banditry in Palestine and introduced a period of security there such as Palestine had never seen before or since, I guess. But it was introduced then and lasted for 2 or 3 centuries. The Romans introduced comparative peace and safety throughout this big area. And so not only could men like Paul travel and preach the gospel, businessmen could travel about looking for opportunities of commerce. Tourists could go from place to place. People of various types. They might hear Paul preach in Athens, and 2 months later they might be in Egypt or in North Africa and tell people what they'd heard. And thus there were all these means of spreading information, which would have been impossible 2 centuries before. The comparative peace and safety that the Roman Empire provided was a tremendous advantage to Christianity. And closely related to that is number 2, the lack of borders. The lack of borders. You don't realize that perhaps so much now in our country, perhaps not in Europe. You realize it more when you get behind the Iron Curtain or when you get over into Asia. I decided a couple of weeks ago, I didn't want to travel all night. And I found the best way to avoid it would be to stop at Tehran in Persia for a night. And so I looked up, what would I have to do? I needed no visas for any country I went to in Europe. I needed no visa for Pakistan. But in order to stop overnight in Persia, I had to get a visa. Well, I made inquiry, there's no charge for the visa, and I thought I'll get it in Rome, because here I'd have to go to New York or Washington to get it. So in Rome, I inquired about the Persian embassy and consulate. And I just inquired when they'd be open. I thought I could go in and get a visa. Well, they said you must get a picture. So I went to one of these machines and stood in front and dropped 16 cents into it and saw myself as I really look, and it was terrible. I tried it 2 or 3 times before I got one that I wasn't too ashamed of. <laughs> Then I got this picture, and then I had to find this place way on the outskirts of Rome. There I had to go in and meet these people who, these Persians who were in Italy. They spoke Italian, they spoke Persian, they spoke a little English. I was able to talk, answer why I was going, and so on, everything. Fortunately, they didn't, like so many countries would, make you come back 2 days later to get it. They gave it to me on the spot. So that night I was able to sleep in Persia. But right after World War I, in fact, a few years after World War I, when I was studying in Germany, at that time you had to pay $10 for a visa for every country in Europe. If you wanted to visit 20 countries, there'd be $200 in visa. And sometimes you'd have to wait half a day at the embassy in order to get it. These borders are being done away with in certain areas now. In other areas, they're as strong as ever. But if the Roman Empire gave a large area with no such borders to make it difficult to go back and forth from one area to the other. And so that was a very tremendous advantage for the spread of Christianity. And number three is the Roman roads. Now these may originally have had a military purpose. The Romans wanted to be able to get their army quickly to any part of their empire. But whatever the purpose, the fact is that previous to the Roman Empire, if you wanted to travel anywhere, you had a muddy, boggy dirt road or a little trail to travel in, and it was difficult. And the Romans built roads that compare with our roads today. Of course, they weren't as wide as ours today, but some of them are in better shape today than some of ours are that were built 20 years ago. They really built them well. And they built these roads radiating from Rome to all parts of the empire. And that made it much easier for Christianity to spread. So in these three ways, the existence of the Roman Empire was a very great advantage to the spread of Christianity. Now there were two great disadvantages to Christianity. We'll call that number six. Disadvantages to Christianity of the existence of the Roman Empire. Now these disadvantages, number one, is the great importance of the personality of the emperor. The great importance of the personality of the emperor. In a human system, that's pretty hard to get away from. Human people tend to idolize individuals and personalities, and the personality in a position of power gets tremendous influence. But under the system of the Roman Empire, while there was all this constitutional system which reached into every aspect of life, yet there was the great deal of power the emperor had, and things varied tremendously according to the decisions and ideas of the emperor. Fortunately, the Antonines particularly were men who were really interested in ruling well and interested in the well-being of their people. Titus, the second of the Flavians, is a man who was a man of as fine character as any non-Christian in all history. And the stories they tell about him show what a wonderful man he was. Unfortunately, he was only emperor 2 years before he died. But some of these emperors really sought to do what was best, but then you get a man like Nero, who looked for a scapegoat for his own wickedness and picked the Christians as a scapegoat, or Domitian was similar. And there was this thing that changed so much with the character of the emperor. Well, that's pretty hard to get away from in any nation. Their rulers, their character, their personality can have a great influence. But this was a great factor in influencing or retarding the spread of the gospel. But number two is the development of official opposition to Christianity. And this is a rather strange thing. The development of official opposition to Christianity. It's a rather strange thing because the Romans were very tolerant in matters of religion. They were very tolerant. They did not try to destroy the religions of the nations they conquered. In fact, they usually put up a temple in Rome to the god of any area they conquered. And they were very tolerant to people. And they couldn't, of all the peoples they conquered, the one that they found hardest to understand were the Jews. Because the Jews, one day in seven, they didn't want to work, and the Jews didn't want to bow down before any idol, and there were various things. The Romans would bow down to the idols of all the different nations, and that way would conciliate all the people. But the Jews didn't want to bow down to any of them. And yet, the Romans tolerated Jews. The Romans said, all right, here's a nation, it's a queer nation. We don't understand their attitude. But so long as they're peaceful and pay their taxes, they said, we will tolerate them. And so the Jews had a right to not have to bow down before idols. They had certain rights in the observance of their Sabbath. They had a right to build their synagogues. They had certain privileges throughout the empire. And in the early days of Christianity, they thought of the Christians as just a group of Jews. And therefore, the Romans didn't pay much attention to them. It's a different one of the sects of the Jews, and they have disagreements among themselves, but so long as they are orderly, the Romans weren't interested. But then, when it began to be clear that the Christians weren't Jews, here was a religion which was not the religion of a nation. It was a religion which was different from any of the other religions. It had the points that the Jews had that the Romans didn't like, but they weren't a national thing. They were something that they were saying was what everybody should do. And the result was that you developed quite an antipathy on the part of many of the Romans. And strangely, it was often the best Romans who developed this antipathy. And during a certain period, it was those thought of as the better Romans who persecuted the church, and those you think of as the wicked Romans were the ones who tolerated the church during certain periods.
Did you hear the fear of the Christians?
Well, there are a lot of factors entered in. The one thing was they didn't want any kind of secret organization, anything that could make a rebellion or anything like that. And they felt that here the Jews are a nation, as long as we have the nation under us, we're all right. But now here was a group spreading here and there, having their own private services which they didn't understand. They didn't know what kind of sedition they might be planning. And they'd say, are you loyal to the emperor? Well, of course, we're good loyal Romans. All right, sacrifice incense to the emperor. Well, that was idolatry. So then your Christian says, I can't do that. I can't worship him. Well, they said, how are you loyal then? You're disloyal. You're trying to start a sedition. And so gradually, different people had different attitudes. We look at some of them as we go through. But they're developed, probably with different things entering into it, they're developed an official attitude of opposition to Christianity. Until you find the Emperor Trajan saying, I don't know why it is. I don't know just what's wrong with these Christians, but I understand that they are outlawed, that it's illegal. And so he writes to his governor, and he says, if somebody denounces someone else and says he's a Christian, why, of course, you must kill him. He's against the empire. That's illegal. But he says, if he denounces a man as a Christian and he doesn't prove it, well, you punish the man for making a false denunciation, he says. And he said, so long as they keep quiet and obey the laws, don't search them out. Don't try to interfere with them anyway. But if they are denounced to you, then you have to investigate. That is, Trajan understood this was the established procedure. And he didn't know quite how it had become established. But we look at that a little bit later. But the development of this official opposition to Christianity was a factor that the Roman Empire, up until about 270, it was officially, Christianity officially had no right to exist. That is, it had a right to exist when it was just a Jewish sect. But when it ceased to be a Jewish sect, when it was a different religion, it had no right to exist until about 270, when there was an edict made giving it a right to exist. Well, he couldn't say it. There was no definite law made. It was a definite attitude that developed. And you can't say just when it came about, but by 100, that was the general attitude people had. There's something wrong with this. It's illegal, but most people wouldn't interfere with it. The Roman Empire, the language of the Roman Empire was Latin. The language of the Christian church was Greek. Even in Rome, up until 300 A.D., the language of the Christian church was Greek, not Latin, you see. That is a very important thing, but doesn't come under this head, the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire provided a large area in which they could travel peacefully and protection for them from mob attack or that sort of thing, or from
individuals who might want to interfere with it. It was a very great help to Christianity. Even in the persecution, it was a help. Because the persecution purged the church. And while it was very difficult, the church, humanly speaking, would never have become what it did if it hadn't been for the purges that came through the persecution. And so God used the Roman Empire as an advantage, even through the persecution. But we'll continue there next Tuesday.